Well, Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas. 2 weeks away, and it is 2019. And among other things, we also have another exciting moment happening today, or rather, remembering today. 26 years ago, my mother and father were married. I am not only a benefit from that, but their example has not only set a fine one for the rest of us here, but has been something that God has used it since the foundation of this church. So if you would like to, I know you guys already did, but give them a round of applause under direction, just to note that God has definitely worked a miracle. Oh, that we could live together in peace, let alone among the distinction of sexes. That is a miracle. Well, being that it is the Christmas season, I thought it was very appropriate to discuss with you all here today something very relevant to that time of year. When we're talking about the holidays that we as Christians celebrate, we can pretty much narrow it down to two, apart from the regular celebration that Jesus rose on Sunday. But the very same Sunday we would know as the holiday of Easter. That was the end of Jesus' ministry and the reason why we not only consider him to be who he was, but the very proof that he gave us that that was in fact the case, God made flesh. But what's also important is not just how he left this world, but also how he arrived. And for those of you who know, not only is the resurrection a miracle where God himself directly intervened instead of what normally happens, people staying dead, he rose. There was also another situation that we celebrate on Christmas Day. Now, whether or not historically it actually took place on December 25th, no reason to either debunk or reaffirm that as being the case. The most important thing is that we're celebrating it. But as far as the Christmas holiday, it is centered around the birth of Jesus of Nazareth. And without a doubt, his life, death, and resurrection are some of the most significant events in history. But this life didn't become significant when his earthly ministry began. When he started telling people about the fact that he was God and started doing deeds that backed up his words, that by no means should be looked aside at. But understand as well that, as what was stated before, his arrival was just as significant as his departure. And I'm, of course, referring to the virgin birth. As far as we as Christians should know that we know that we know, that we are following not just a belief, but the true belief, it all centers around that one thing. In fact, his original apostles, followers, and disciples all hammered this point home again and again and again, that if we needed to know anything about Jesus, it doesn't have to be the original Greek. It doesn't have to be whether or not he performed this miracle on Thursday or Friday. It was all centered around his resurrection. In fact, they went so far as to say that in 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 17, if Christ is not risen, your faith is futile. You are still in your sins. We have no hope. So if there's anything for us to know for certain, Easter would definitely be number one. But if we've started at the end, where do we go from there? Maybe at the beginning, right? Just noting the stuff in between is recorded for us in the Gospels. But if we can know beyond a shadow of a doubt, historically, if we can test and conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that Jesus of Nazareth did indeed rise from the dead in a moment of history, do you think that maybe we can apply the same rules, the same tests, and know with the same certainty that the first miracle was true, that he was in fact born of a virgin? Well, that's what I'd like to discuss with you here today. Three things that I want you guys to take away from this holiday season, just in case you were missing Pastor Scott, where we are going to point out first the historical reality of the virgin birth. How do we know that this actually took place in history and can test it to any fair inquirer? Secondly, the doctrinal significance of the virgin birth. Why should it matter to us as Christians, not only conceptually in our minds, but biblically in his word? What is the significance of Jesus being born beyond normal means of conception? And finally, the prophetic significance. Why did the virgin birth take place at all from God's perspective? Why was this the way in which he would enter the world? Why did it have to be? Well, that's what we're going to discuss here today. So starting with the first one, the historical proof of the virgin birth. Can it be tested and known beyond a reasonable doubt? Well, once again, as what was stated in our introduction, the resurrection is one of the most verifiable events in ancient history. And when they're testing something according to that standard, understand that if we're going to, say, hold up this paper or even, say, this book, these flaps of driftwood are only going to last 50 years at best if I take good care of them. And given the demands that the junior hires often put me through, yes, I'm looking at you, Elise, we are talking about maybe 20 at most. But when we're talking about the preservation of ancient text, even if they take really good care of them, even if they write them down on sheet metal, is it reasonable to demand an ocean of evidence for stuff that took place 1,000 or more years in the past? Absolutely not. Not only do circumstances and weather stand in the way of that, but also just the overall decay of time. So as far as secular sources are concerned, as far as ancient historical criticism, lots of big words today, we are talking about a standard that demands two at most. If more, better. But two separate sources that both say basically the same thing is how we can know something happened 1,000 or more years ago beyond a reasonable doubt. We got two sources, it's as good as gold. Can we test the resurrection by those standards? Absolutely. We not only have the eyewitness accounts, and if you consider the Gospels all one source, which most secular sources would throw out, we not only have that, but also contemporary writings of Christians and non-Christians that both acknowledge the death, which is required if you're going to rise from the dead, you have to die, but also the appearances of Jesus to his later followers. We discussed that the last time I had the honor of standing before you. But can we hold the virgin birth to those same standards? Well, once again, how many different sources do we need to know for certain something happened in ancient history? I'll give you four. First, regarding the information that we have from the eyewitnesses, if we're going to test any evidence, we need to have people who saw it and people, places, or things that back up what those sources originally said. What did the eyewitnesses have to say? Well, Jesus of Nazareth was born under one of a number of censuses, that's easy for me to say, ordered by Caesar Augustus during the reign of a man named Quirinius as governor of Syria in the town of Bethlehem during the reign of King Herod the Great, among other things. A lot of historical details, but then we have to ask, what people, places, or things back up what they said? Well, firstly, regarding the census, which I think is important if the government's going to be gathering money from its subjects, I think they would have written down receipts and so forth. Well, there was an interesting discovery as to whether or not this would have taken place during this time in history that was made by a historian by the name of Dr. Jack Finnegan in his book Light of Ancient Past, where he said the following. As to taking of such an enrollment in general, it is known from discoveries among Egyptian papyri that a Roman census was taken in Egypt, and therefore, perhaps throughout the empire, regularly, every 14 years. Many actual census returns have been found, and they use the very same word in Greek which Luke used in his second chapter in verse 2 as the use for enrollment. So if we're going to ask, okay, did an actual census take place at this time in history? Well, we have tangible records of censuses taking place throughout the Roman Empire. And according to this historian, who, though he is a Christian, he does put his money where his mouth is, in reporting that this isn't his opinion in saying this. They have records of censuses being reported in Egypt, which was near the region of Judea, and doing so at regular intervals. So if we have evidence, say, for, and we'll get to this in a moment, a census that took place a few, maybe 5 or 6 years after the book, The Birth of Jesus, what then could we conclude? Did Luke get the date wrong, or maybe was that not the only census? We have evidence to suggest that in other places of the Roman Empire, censuses were a regular thing. So is it unreasonable for us to believe historically that Luke reported a census taking place in Judea before and after the ones that we have records of? I think that it is reasonable to say that. Secondly, was Luke a reliable historian in general? Well, according to the writings of Sir William Ramsay, who at the time of doing his research was not a Christian, but after assessing the evidence of the Gospel of Luke and criticizing it as a historical source, he became a Christian after the writings of his book, St. Paul, a Traveler and a Roman Citizen. The historical works of the highest order, which a writer commands excellent means of knowledge, either through personal acquaintance or through access to original authorities, and brings treatment of his subject genius, literary skill, and sympathetic historical insight into human character and the movement of events. Such an author seizes the critical events, concentrates the reader's attention on them by giving them fuller treatment. This was referring to the writing style and accuracy of Luke the physician. Now, of all the sources that I could cite to you regarding Jesus' birth and the circumstances involved in there, we of course can go to Matthew chapter 2 and regarding the events that took place there. And it's not unreasonable to say that Matthew, as a tax collector, would have known and had access to Roman census reports, since he was one of the people taking the censuses. Well, there's another interesting thing here. Luke, as a historian, was not an eyewitness to anything that he reported, nor was Matthew for that matter. But they did have access, according to modern historians, to the material that they needed based on the evidence of their report that would make it exemplary, even by today's standards, as far as a historical record was concerned. We have every reason to believe that Luke not only knew how to record history, but do it right and in a clear way that can be easily understood. So what do we have thus far according to modern scholars? We have evidence from Egyptian records that there was, in fact, a regular cycle of censuses taking place in the Roman Empire at this time in history. Likewise, we also have modern scholars reporting that Luke, in fact, knew how to record history and did a good job even by today's standards. But what about ancient sources? What about people who were actually around at this time and a little bit closer to the events that took place? Well, for those of you who were here last time, you may recognize the name Tacitus. He was a Roman historian, born, of course, after the time of Jesus, but during the time that the early Christians were making their mark on the world scene. And as a Roman citizen and a historian, he was required to give reports of those who represented the Roman Empire, give a list of politicians and their honors, if you will. And he mentions three individuals. Quirinius, who died in 21 AD. Was that before or after he supposedly reigned during the birth of Jesus? A date checks out. But he also acknowledges the existence of other historical figures like Herod the Great and Caesar Augustus in his book Annals, chapter 3, section 48. I get confused when noting verses in the Bible interchangeably. You'll forgive me. Chapter 3, section 48 notes this in Annals, and that is important for you guys to understand, because if he's referencing these people closer to the events, then we can A, know that they weren't fiction, but B, check the dates and note he would have been around and alive at this time. And if Luke knew how to record history, even according to modern standards, then that just puts one piece closer to where it belongs in the puzzle, doesn't it? Now, that is not all I promised you for, and I will be a man of my word in this regard. When we're talking about sources that give us actual details as far as these things, what reason do we have to believe that this guy Quirinius did the things that Luke said he did during the time of which they were supposedly done, during this situation of which we're trying to prove actually has a place in history, not in fiction? Well, Flavius Josephus will be the fourth source here today. And once again, for those of you who like doing a bit of history in the Bible, you'd know he's a best friend of us scholars. And he made the point in his book, The Antiquities of the Jews, chapter 18, section 1-2, that Quirinius reigned over Syria twice, the second of which was in 7 AD. Is that after Jesus' birth? What about before? Could his first reign as governor of Syria been when Luke reported? I don't think that goes beyond the realm of possibility. But not only that, Josephus also recorded more than any other ancient historian about the exploits of Herod the Great. Now, you would remember one of the interesting details that Matthew gives us about Jesus' birth and the events surrounding it, that Herod ordered a mass extermination of children 2 years and younger in the city of Bethlehem when the Magi did not return to him with news of his location. Now, think about this for a second. Josephus did not report that. But if you were a Jewish person employed by the Roman Empire to report things about the people they elected, would wiping out an entire city's worth of babies from 0 to 2 years old be very high on your list of achievements? Okay, so maybe not write that one down. We have reason to believe, or not only reason to believe, but reason to conclude why he left that out. But given that Luke is a reliable recorder of history, given that we have physical evidence of censuses being a regular thing in the Roman Empire, given that we have multiple non-Christian sources reporting the existence of characters that were playing vital roles at this time and this place in this moment of history, that is the historical proof that we have to believe that Jesus was in fact born at this time. So, history. Do we have reason to believe? Well, according to the most ardent skeptic, we have two separate sources that note the same basic details about an event, good as gold history can be. I just gave you four. But for us as Christians, I'm basically speaking to the choir here. We believe the virgin birth. Sean, just get on to the main point. What difference does it make? Well, I'm glad you asked, because that's what brings us on to the second section, the doctrinal significance of the virgin birth. What does it mean for us as Christians today? Well, quite a few things. I'll lay it down to three, just for the sake of time. When we're discussing our problem, and the very problem that Jesus came here to solve, what more would we want to address and need addressed before God than our sin issue? And when it comes to our relationship with God, that is the one thing that needs to be dealt with and that Jesus himself came to this world to deal with in the first place. Where does the virgin birth fit into that? Well, believe it or not, the first prophetic prediction of Jesus' coming wasn't found in Isaiah, wasn't found in Samuel, but it was actually going all the way back to the book of Genesis, chapter 3. If you can turn there in verses 15 through 17, the curse is described for us that God placed on the serpent. Now, understand that the term serpent means shining one, so it isn't necessarily referring to a biological snake. But this was addressed at Satan, I'm sure we can all here agree. And the curse that God laid towards Satan wasn't just that he'd be thrown down to the earth and be required to eat dirt, but from the seed of woman, his head would be crushed. I won't go into too many details for you as far as what that term means, but understand that the emphasis is the focus on a woman, not a man, regarding this male child and what he would ultimately do to Satan. When we're talking about Jesus and his ultimate accomplishment, when he said, "It is finished," when he destroyed Satan's power over us forever, the reason that we celebrate Easter and what he did on that day, what brought him to this world in the first place? A woman without a man. Now note, if you only had Genesis 3, 14 through 17 to go on, might be a bit of a stretch. That's why further details were given later on. But the emphasis and focus isn't just on original sin, but also noting who Jesus was, God with us. We'll get more into that direct statement here in a moment, but I want you guys to understand why this is key. Of all of us born in this room, my parents, I can speak directly, they were both necessary to bring me into this world. Anyone here the exception? Glad we've clarified that. So if we're going to discuss a moment in history where God came to this earth, would we expect there to be a few exceptions? Would we expect him to be a little bit more unique? Would we expect a detail pointed out to us that would cause us to realize there's something special about this one? Third, fulfilled prophecy. We are given details as to where, when, and why this child would be born. When God, who essentially set up the deck in his favor, laying down predictions that were so specific and so narrowed down to the detail as far as us not having any excuse as to whether or not recognize Jesus as, in fact, the one who he said he was and proved who he said he was and did the sort of things that eyewitnesses beyond any reasonable expectation, as far as ancient history is concerned, report that he did, we are required to come to a conclusion. But we're focusing on the Christmas season. Where in the Bible does it give us where Jesus would be born? Micah chapter 5 and verse 2. You, Bethlehem, Ephrathah, though you are least among the children of Judah, out of you will come one whose goings forth are from old, from everlasting. Someone's going to be born from you that has always existed. Who qualifies under that category? Secondly, regarding the when, we're given a time frame, not just geographically, but chronologically, when in history the Messiah needed to show up. And this would be found in two places. First, in Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 through 26. And secondly, in Genesis chapter 49 and verse 10. I'll address them in order. When we're discussing Daniel 9, 24 through 26, we essentially have God's plan for man overviewed at 30,000 feet. And if you want the condensed version, it is noting that whatever separates us from God will be dealt with, every promise God ever made will be fulfilled, and heaven will be finally brought to this earth through the words and deeds of this Messiah, this anointed one, this man, this Son of Man, who would also be called the Son of God. And notes that from the going forth, catch this, something's going to be said, of the order to rebuild the wall. Whose wall? Daniel chapter 9 gives us the context. Speaking to your people, Daniel. Was Daniel Jewish or Persian? Noted. From the order to rebuild the wall, even in troublesome times. If you read the book of Nehemiah, you would wholeheartedly agree, as well as in Ezra. There will be 70 weeks total, but 62 and 7 from the time of the ordering from that wall until he comes. Now, 69, 62 plus 7 is 69. 69 of these weeks, how many days are in a week? Well, the term in Hebrew is Shabuah, which just means a unit of seven. And in this context, the Hebrew actually informs us that it was years. So if we have 483 years from an order in history to rebuild the Jewish people's wall, what took place after King Artaxerxes Long Dominus gave the order for Nehemiah to rebuild Jerusalem's wall so they can live in safety during the troublesome times that they were living in? We bring ourselves to 30 AD, where a carpenter from Nazareth turned significant religious teacher, rabbi, miracle worker, entered in reference to Zechariah chapter 12 on a donkey and her colt. But also understand as well, we're not just talking about Easter Sunday, are we? I also mentioned Genesis chapter 49 and verse 10, where the prophecy was given by Jacob to his son Judah, the progenitor of Jesus' family line. He was the lion of the tribe of Judah, in case you were wondering. He was from that tribe of Israel. The scepter shall not depart from Judah until Shiloh, the bringer of peace, appears. The scepter was a way in the ancient world of essentially asserting your authority. If you remember the story of Esther, for instance, her main concern was because the Persians were living in the Middle East, for starters, but among other things, if someone came into the room and the king didn't know him, intentions are now in question. So what the king would be required to do is there would be a signal given to his bodyguards that if anyone came into that room, they would be killed on the spot unless his scepter was raised. This was the power to give life or take it. What is being referred to when it talks about the scepter departing from Judah? Well, until a certain time in history, Israel had the right to capital punishment. Their governing leaders, kings or otherwise, had the right to sentence people to death according to Moses' law. The Jews, living under Hellenistic, Babylonian, Persian, all the way into Roman times, had the right to order people to be stoned to death until the Jewish zealots, the people not too happy politically with the current election, hashtag not my emperor, were finally fed up with all of the uprisings and said, that's it, our governors are now going to have this right, you no longer have it. Take a guess when in history Israel lost that right? It would have been around the time of Jesus' bar mitzvah. Note and point, but we're also wanting to know why. And this is where we get to our third point. In Isaiah chapter 7 and verse 14, we are given the details as to why Jesus was going to come, why he needed to be born of a virgin, why we are celebrating Christmas. Now, I understand, and I'm fully sympathetic here as one of the younger in the audience here today. I had to go through a few Mickey Mouse Clubhouse episodes before the true spirit of Christmas and the Donald Duck specials and stuff, before it actually sunk in that it involved more than just presents. I think the My Little Pony Christmas special in season 4 solidified it for me, but that's another story. My father and his older brother, Rick, actually had an interesting conversation, you may have heard this story, with his parents, where my grandparents, where they asked, because their neighbors had 8 days of presents. They were Jewish, not Christian, but they still celebrated Christmas anyway. They were American, so nominally Christian, but not practicing. And so they celebrated Christmas just like most of us will be doing here today. And my dad looked at my grandma and said, why can't we convert to Judaism? I'd like more days of presents. And I understand the child's logic. But regarding the reason for the season, why exactly are we discussing this here today? Why did it have to happen this way? Well, if I'm going to summarize it for you and save 15 minutes, I'll just say, because God said so. But because that shouldn't satisfy you, because while trusting God is important, the reason we trust God by faith, faith meaning trust with reason, I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't give you reasons to believe that was, in fact, what God said and where. So let's go a little bit into detail about that statement. Where did God say that this child born of a virgin would, in fact, be God with us? If you can turn to the book of Isaiah, chapter 7, and verse 10, I'd like to read to you the whole conversation. Moreover, the Lord spoke again to Ahaz, saying, ask a sign for yourself from the Lord your God. Ask it either in the depth or in the height above, as low as you want or as great as you want. Ahaz, you got a free request from God. But Ahaz said, I will not ask, nor will I test the Lord. Now, this sounds very magnanimous and pious. Oh, I don't want to expect anything from God. You know, the classic, you know, person that always gives you that hard time on Christmas. What do you want? Oh, I don't want anything. Just something small. Throw me a bone, woman. That's the point that we're trying to make here. Well, basically, he's dismissing the topic because he knows at the moment that God gives him reasons to trust him, I'm now obliged to. For those of you who have read 2 Kings, would you give a yay or nay as far as Ahaz's relationship with God? Nay, nay indeed. In fact, more nays than a horse would even utter. We are talking about a guy who is so corrupt, he sacrificed his newborn sons, plural, on brass ovens to the pagan god Moloch so that he could get blessings from a god that didn't even exist. And God is willing to reach out to this guy. 2 points for grace, 1 point for mercy. But when we're talking about these things, we're talking about a guy who isn't rejecting an offer from God because he doesn't want to trouble God. And Isaiah points that out. He says, hear now, O house of David, is it a small thing for you to weary men, but now you weary my God also? Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and you shall call his name Emmanuel. But it doesn't stop there. Curds and honey he shall eat, that he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good. But before the child knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land that you dread, who's he speaking to again? Okay, Ahaz is the addressed audience. The land that you dread will be forsaken by both her kings, for by both her kings. Let me enunciate the right word here. The Lord will bring the king of Assyria upon you, and your people and your father's house, days that have not come since the day that Ephraim departed from Judah. Now, normally when we cite this passage around Christmas season, we just read verse 14 and leave it there. But understand that this whole conversation in Scripture is five chapters long, starting at chapter 7 and ending at chapter 12. And understand this as well. What would include chapters 7 through 12? Another one you may be familiar with concerning Jesus, Isaiah 9 and verse 6. Those of you guys who may remember it, the government shall be upon his shoulders. He shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Father of Eternity, Prince of Peace. Well, when we're talking about these things, I want to make sure you understand the prophecy in context so that we're taking away what was intended by the original author. The who was King Ahaz, the corrupt king of Judah. Kind of throws a monkey wrench in that whole idea that the Bible was written as a propaganda to make Israel feel good about itself if it talked that way about its kings. But that's another topic. Where did this take place? Southern Israel, also known as the Kingdom of Judah. When did this take place? Well, we have records outside of the Bible, not only the Torah, but other writings of Israel's enemies, that would date Ahaz's reign in two sections. 20 years total, the Bible would affirm that, but the first 10 were spent as a regent king. He co-kinged, essentially, until his elder died, and he took over for the last 10 years. These years were from 736 to 716 BC. 736 to 716 BC. Keep that in mind. When did the king that he was afraid of, the world-ruling superpower, the chief military force, the big guy on the block, the neighborhood bully, during this time in history? His name was Sargon II, king of Syria. Who did Isaiah predict would be taken over this big guy on the block? Assyria, two separate nations. Syria's capital was Damascus. Assyria's capital was Nineveh. Cite to Jonah for those of you listening. But understand this as well. These words were spoken from a perspective outside of time and space. It is in the prophetic section of the Old Testament. That's how it's meant to be approached. And if we're talking about a guy like Sargon II, who ruled the Syrian kingdom at its end, when did that end take place? Well, remind me, 736 to 716, that was when Ahaz reigned, right? When did Sargon II start swinging around his military force? 722 to 705. The dates check out. But understand this as well. What was this prophecy initially about? In verse 3 of chapter 7, Isaiah brings up that his son's name that was just born was named Shir-Jashub, which means a remnant. And this was to be a sign to King Ahaz that God was still in charge, even if he didn't acknowledge his authority. The king represents God to his nation. Now, he had every reason to recognize that God in authority of him, and this child would be proof. Until this child knows the difference between right and wrong, he's old enough to be held accountable for his actions, whether that's the time of his bar mitzvah at 12 or not, you be the judge. But understand the point that's being made here. When this child is weaned from mama and is able to eat curds and honey, this was the prophecy, the kingdom of Syria will fall. Assyria will take him over, and the king that you fear is not going to touch you. Why? So that you know God is still with you. That was the prophecy. Now, a sign higher than the heights more significant than anything he would have to offer. I'm throwing myself under the bus here a little bit with this, but when I, many Christmases ago, when puppies were the oldest animals, I was short. And in this short state, my brain was also less creative than it was in this day and age. And my B-paw, as we called him, my father's father, a medical malpractice attorney, just come off a big case and was more than willing to show that this pocket was full of power, if you know what I mean. So he came to his only grandson, which I was regularly a participant in, and said, "We're going to go to Toys R Us, Sean." Oh, yeah, that's what I was saying. "And I want you to go into the store and pick out any one thing that you can think of." I was four. So think about this for a second. In 1998, what options were available to me? Well, we had Star Wars Return of the Jedi coming out. Could have gotten some of those big Lego sets. Could have gotten a, you know, training bicycle. Could have gotten some of those Tyco RC things. Heck, maybe lawn darts weren't outlawed yet. Who knows? But when we're talking about the options available to me, what do you think would have happened if I instead turned to my grandpa and said, "Grandpa, I want you to pick out something for me"? I think his head would be going at an angle looking at some of the top shelf items as far as how he was prepared to spoil his grandson, as grandparents are required to do. But instead, I chose a red ball from the dollar rack that popped the same day. Ahaz essentially rejects Grandpa's offer, but you have to ask the question, if God himself said, "I'm going to give you a sign," do you think he's going to aim it pretty up here? Or do you think he's going to settle for Sean at 4 years old level stuff? Absolutely not. So if we're talking about a sign to end all signs, Isaiah chapter 7 and verse 14, in context, what did he get? This kid will not turn 12 before the king of Syria is taken over by Assyria. Now, a prophetic calendar in the life of a child, you know, every baby's a miracle, I understand that, but is this a sign to end all signs? This girl's going to have a baby, and this baby, before he's all growled up, is going to make sure that that nation is not going to be a threat to you any longer. That's neat, but is that Return of the Jedi level Star Wars stuff? No. So what else is going on here? Where else is this cited in Scripture? Well, Matthew chapter 1, verses 22 through 23 cites this. "So all this was done," the Christmas story, "that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the Lord through the prophet, saying, 'Behold, the virgin shall be with child, bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel,'" which is translated "God with us." Now understand this. Two fulfillments. We have short-term, little remnant here, before he's old enough to, well, first off, mom's not obligated to wear those drapes in public, but also he's going to be able to eat more than just spaghetti on his own, if you understand the point. A kingdom's going to be taken over, and you're no longer going to be in danger from Syria. That's neat. But what's the ultimate fulfillment? What's the later fulfillment? What's the messianic, the Messiah referenced fulfillment? The virgin birth. If I'm going to say those words, let's at least be consistent. Is that the only time we would ever apply that rule to a prediction in the Old Testament? If I say that in immediate historical context, this prophecy predicted something and it came true, but that's all, and I later apply it to Jesus, but I never do that anywhere ever, that's unreasonable on my part, correct? If I say, "Oh, this makes me think of Jesus, so it is now," that's not good hermeneutics, if you want to use the fancy term. That's not good Bible interpretation. Where else do we apply this rule? Well, forget we. Let's go to people who don't even believe that Jesus is the Messiah, shooting themselves in the foot and recognizing this same rule applies throughout Scripture. Let's start with the Messianic Psalms. In Psalm 2, it is both discussing, not according to me, Christians acknowledge this too, but the chief rabbis before and after the time of Jesus, not believing in him, acknowledge that there is not only a reference to God's presence in Jerusalem, but the Messiah's authority to judge evil. Dual predictions. Secondly, we have Psalm 22, Psalm 40, and Psalm 69 discussing both David and the Messiah's sufferings. There is a historical and a later application. We have Psalm 109 discussing David dealing with persecution and the Messiah's rejection from Israel. I could go on in this. We can discuss the end times. Daniel 11 discussing not only the tyrant Greek king Antiochus Epiphanes, but also the later incarnation of Satan during what is called Jacob's trouble, or as we would call it, the Great Tribulation. We can discuss Joel chapter 2, verses 28 through 32, discussing a current plague of locusts in Joel's time in history and a coming plague of locusts during the time of Jacob's trouble. Revelation even discarded. We have historical references with prophetic meaning. We can discuss Isaiah 14, where it discusses the king of Babylon and Satan's fall. We can discuss Isaiah 10, where the king of Assyria's exploits are mentioned, and the future incarnation of Satan, the ultimate king of Assyria. We can discuss, this one's my favorite, the prediction and announcement that David was, in fact, God's chosen king of Israel. Do the Jews recognize David as their boy? Absolutely. But understand this as well. The Jewish rabbis would use the same approach that we take to Isaiah 7 and apply it to 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 12 through 16, where it not only recognizes David as the king of Israel, not Saul, but also the one who will in future time bring the Messiah into this world. It is not unreasonable to take this approach to Scripture, Christian or not. So in conclusion, if we're consistent, the same standards of the resurrection as a historical fact also affirm the virgin birth. First, we have sources inside and outside the Bible that set it in the realm of nonfiction with reliable authors to boot. Second, we have Old and New Testament application that all apply directly to our salvation and reasons to trust God's promises. But third and most importantly, we have multiple examples of the Messiah being referenced alongside statements that also applied to moments in history before Jesus that even Jewish scholars are willing to admit are messianic. There's the information. Now you can do something with it. My recommendation is in 6 days, count them among your reasons to be thankful, along with the abundance that we can enjoy as Americans, free to practice this religion while we still can. Not because it feels good, not because of our community, but because we can know and test that it is true. Dad, thank you that you have given us more than enough reasons to trust you and that we live in a time and an age where a few Google searches could confirm this information if we're willing to apply the right tests. Dad, you've given a witness of yourself in history, not just in your resurrection, but even in your arrival. And so we not only want to say thank you for dying for us, but even coming to this rotten and fallen world. As we are seeing more and more, this world is dying. Your children are suffering, but your promises remain true. You did not leave us to suffer alone. In fact, you voluntarily, as the only one exempt from our suffering, suffered alongside us, not just as the creator of the universe, exempt from everything wrong with this world, but made yourself dependent on us, needing food, needing nourishment, needing protection. And knowing that level of understanding, it's just something that even all of our brains can't even wrap themselves around. So instead of arguing, we just want to say thank you. instead of taking this evidence as reason to trust, we just want to ask that you would reinforce this as more and more reasons to trust your word. And we want to say thank you for it, for declaring to us not only Easter, but Christmas. We pray this in your name. Amen.